It's Wednesday, November 4th, 2020, and this is another socially distant edition of KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from various spots within the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm in the Futures Lab studio in the basement of the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and my colleagues Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley are in other corners of our complex. Hello to you, Ernest.
Hello, how are you?
Doing okay, Kathy. Good afternoon as we're recording this.
Yes, good to see you so far and yet so near.
Yes, well, it's been a long, long couple of hours, a long night. It's been a long morning, and now we're making our way through a long afternoon. I just mentioned it's afternoon. We should note that we record this show on Wednesday afternoons at 2 p.m. So some of you might be watching in real time through our Facebook live stream or watching it on demand. Some of you might be listening to this on KBIA or watching it on a tape delay on television. Just know as we have this conversation that it is pre-recorded. So, Kathy, I want to start by asking you if you could maybe provide us with one of your biggest takeaways from the last 12 to 24 hours.
Well, I would say that this is going to be a long, fasten your seatbelts, because I covered the 2000 post-election election. And I think this is going to make that look like patty cake. So I would just say settle in. It's going to be a really, I don't know if it's going to be a great show, but it's going to be a long show.
What makes you say that?
Well, I think because I think Democrats, Biden supporters, I think had hoped to really score a knockout punch early last night. They had hoped that some of these states that they were hoping to flip, like Florida or North Carolina, would go early, and that that then this would be an unquestioned, the results would be unquestioned. I think by pushing this result later into this week, it looks like it encourages what President Trump had already signaled he planned to do, which is a succession of legal battles. And having been involved covering those in 2000, I think, you know, this could go right up to Inauguration Day.
Ernest, response or reaction to that?
I think that, you know, Kathy brings up some very good points. I'm not sure whether it's going to go up to Inauguration Day, but it's definitely going to be a battle along the lines of what we saw in 2000, mainly because you know, Trump had signaled that this is where he was going to go if the results came out this way. I mean, it is quite interesting that what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2018 appears to be happening to President Trump. I mean, not 2018, 2016, mm-hmm. appears to be happening to President Trump here in 2020. And we didn't see a lot of those legal challenges under Clinton. But you definitely can expect it to be this way under Trump, because they literally saved a lot of their campaign money for just this. So as Kathy said, hang on, we're going for a ride.
So that ride, I don't want to say it started, it continued in the very, very early hours of this morning, 1-2 o'clock this morning, when the president did go on the air and say that he had won the election. And he had hinted that that was going to be happening. There were also insiders who said that this was going to be decided on election night because that's what he wanted. One of the things, though, and I will be the first to say I was asleep by the time this happened, but one of the things that was most interesting to me as I was going back and reading about what happened, watching some of the clips, was that all of the major networks ended up cutting away from the president of the United States lying about winning re-election. I thought it was a very interesting move that all of the networks did that.
Yeah, and you noticed this morning, I mean, when I heard the stories about the president's remarks, they were all couched with all kinds of qualifying language saying, this isn't true. So this is a perfect example of, to coin the phrase that Kellyanne Conway famously coined at the very beginning of the Trump administration,
alternative facts. Yeah. Ernest, you were about to say something.
Well, no, I was going to, along the same lines. I mean, I think that they had, many of them knew that this was going to happen. I mean, not that Trump was signaling it or his people said anything, but they were like, you know, if it's close, he's going to claim that he's won the election. And sure enough, that's what happened. And they all said, you know, at least most of them said, you know, we're not going to contribute to what is already a stressful process. And we know that this is going to lag on for another couple of weeks. Just the counting of the ballots alone, as we sit here, has already been predicted to stretch out until Friday, mm-hmm. because Pennsylvania is not going to have its mail-in ballots counted until Friday at the earliest. So, you know, we won't know where Pennsylvania is, and it could be the one state that sort of tips everything over, even though as we record here right now, Biden has more ways in which to win this election than Trump does.
One of the other things that was really interesting, Fox News, well, we saw all of the networks being really guarded in how they were calling races, trying to prevent that that moment from 2000 where they had to pull back Florida and everything fell apart from there. And so you saw the networks being significantly guarded in their calls. If I spent most of the evening watching MSNBC, NBC, and ABC, and I noticed throughout the night they were usually behind what the New York Times had and even further behind the Associated Press. Interestingly enough, the first to call Arizona was Fox News. And many a times when Fox News, when people asked about it, it was clear from hearing from different insiders that this decision for Fox to go ahead and call Arizona was infuriating to him. Word of that gets to those on set who ask the person from their numbers desk, are we sure about this? And that guy says, that journalist who's crunching those numbers, to within 4 standard deviations, we know we've got Arizona. Thoughts about Fox being the first and so adamantly, Ernest, let me ask you about that, so adamantly to call that first flip state?
Yeah, I mean, that was surprising to me that Fox would be the one stepping out there. It was kind of interesting because sort of when I tuned in to the election results, this morning, you still had many of the other networks basically saying that, no, we don't know about Arizona. And then they put in the caveat, however, it has been called by others.
By other networks.
And they didn't, by the networks, mm-hmm. they didn't say which. And so to the, you know, I guess the untrained eye, you kind of go like, okay, what other network are we talking about? And then you start flipping channels trying to figure out who did it. And the fact that it was Fox sort of just made, you know, when I heard that, I went like, Fox, how, what, you know? And then to get, you know, the president's reaction to it, I went like, well, you know, when the network that is giving you so much free airtime and the one that is connected to you and your campaign more than any other calls Arizona to the other guy, maybe they know something that the other networks didn't know. So I found it really strange.
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of people on Fox News who are 100% straight reporters. I think people oftentimes conflate the evening shows, and it's really true now that every cable network in their prime time, sadly, is doing opinion. You know, they've got people who are commentators, opinion commentators, who are basically running these chat shows in the evenings and on primetime TV, and but in the daytime, all of these networks are, if you tune in, it's straight news. And so I believe Chris Wallace was one of the anchors who was the most critical, vocal about Donald Trump's remarks last night. Brett Baer is an absolute, you know, he's 100% reporter. So, and obviously the number crunchers at any network. I think people need to understand that journalists are proud of their work. We are proud of what we do, and we want to be accurate. And so there may be some people at these networks who are kowtowing to what they perceive to be the boss's biases, but most journalists aren't that way. And I think it's really important for people to understand that.
So as we talk about being proud of our work, let me ask you, and Kathy, I'll start with you, then we'll go to Ernest. Anything that you have seen either during the day yesterday, last night, today, that really impressed you, something that you as a journalist are proud to say, hey, I know that person who did that cool thing, or if you haven't seen this yet, you really need to check this out?
You know, there isn't one thing. I've seen and watched a lot, and I feel like if I singled somebody out, I'd be unfair to people who are working hard. I would say the thing that impresses me is the teamwork. Obviously, we know, because we know what's involved in putting together these projects, these packages, that you can't do this kind of coverage on deadline and be accurate and be comprehensive without a big team of journalists behind you. And I would say some of the infographics I've seen on some of the major national websites, and even some of our local websites like the Columbia, Missouri, and the maps that people are producing, and the things that really I think make a very complex situation. We've got the control of the House was at its stake, the control of the Senate is still at stake, and the White House too. And I think a lot of those infographics have been spectacular, frankly. And I also think something that you called out, Amy, which is the measured way that this has been covered, and the very the heavy emphasis on explanatory journalism as opposed to clickbait really has been important, and I think it reflects really well on our profession.
Ernest, you like to talk about the idea and the importance of context, and maybe what Kathy's really talking about in that measured response is that journalists have done a really good job of putting what is happening right now today into context and reporting it in a way that really educates, while it informs, while it gives people what they need.
I would agree with the statement that you just made. I mean, the journalists right now at this particular moment, and even going into when the polls were closed, have demonstrated to me a lot of patience. And I think the fact that they're being patient is helping the country to be patient with what's happening. Because going back to 2000, I mean, there was hysteria. Not just among the politicos, but also the journalists, mm-hmm. which sort of fed into the angst and anxiety that the country as a whole was feeling about what was going to happen in that election, the whole hanging chads and where were these ballots going to be held.
I still have a picture of that guy who's looking at the hanging chads on my desk.
Right, no, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and I, you know, you don't see that now. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the journalists started out yesterday mm-hmm. being patient about what was going to take place. We already knew that there were going to be a lot of mail-in ballots. We knew that there were a lot of absentee ballots that needed to be counted. We were told by election officials, state after state, it's going to take us a while because this is new. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We are dealing with economic upheaval. You had, you know, this gate being put around the White House. I mean, that was the other thing that we hadn't really talked about, is the extraordinary level of security that was placed around certain places, as if there was this belief that there was going to be this sort of violent upheaval, and that didn't happen, you know. And a lot of that was being pushed. That narrative was being pushed by the president and his supporters, and to have those barriers go up around the White House during an election, just, you know, I'm sitting there going like, wait a minute, why are we putting up, you know, no climbing fences around the White House during an election? We've never had to do that
before. Or boarding up windows.
Boarding up doors and windows and all of these things, you know, and I think in some ways, the journalists were being patient, but I also think the American public sort of looked at it and were like, whoa, wait a minute, you know? So you're anticipating that if one side doesn't win over the other, that there's going to be rioting in the streets. No, we're not doing that, you know? And as you've seen, here we are the day after, and none of that took place. You had sporadic instances of issues where people were intimidated, that sort of thing.
But nothing but more that was out of the nothing that was out of the ordinary. I mean, not to say that it's good that it was ordinary, but it was the run of the mill election intimidation. It was the regular long lines. It was the the same issues that we have in every election and work our way around. And you know, when that happens, polls stay open a little bit later. It's why we're still waiting on Nevada.
No, absolutely. And there was measured coverage of all of it. And I think that was probably, to me, one of the things that I really thought that journalism did well yesterday.
Yeah, so, and I'll
go ahead, Kathy.
Specific, I couldn't think of before, but I think you've seen a number of publications. I'm thinking of one in particular in the New York Times, that because it was about Pennsylvania, my home state, but where you've seen people go in, but even here, the Columbia, Missourian, and do interviews before the election with the elections officials. So really talk about last night on KOMU, we had a reporter right in the elections department showing people through the window, people counting the votes. And I think what that does is it tells people, again, just like we journalists are proud of our work, the public servants who do this every year and don't usually get as much attention as they're getting this year when there's COVID and a lot of complications in the vote count, but they are doing their job as professionals. And I think that's reassuring to people to know these aren't a bunch of hacks. These are actual public servants who do this year in and year out. And I think the journalistic focus on these usually unsung heroes is helpful and deserved.
And it's good storytelling.
You know, and this is one of the things that I think is going to make it difficult for the Trump administration to claim that there's some sort of voter fraud, because there was this transparency on the part of these election officials that allowed journalists to come in and actually watch them do their jobs, and people can see in real time what they're doing. That's going to make it awfully difficult for the whole narrative of voter fraud or some sort of mishandling to take hold.
So, Ernest, I'm going to give you away a little bit. We were talking before the show and about how late we each made it up, what we were watching, and you said that you decided, thinking back about some past elections and how things had gone, that it was going to be a night of rest and relaxation, that it was going to be something you'd catch up on this morning, which I think for a lot more people than you might have thought, or that we might as journalists think, was kind of sort of the norm. So as you woke up this morning, what were some of your very first reactions compared to, say, when you and I were sitting around the table together in a not so socially distant conversation, just like this one with Mike McKean?
I would say for me, I felt a lot less stressed when I woke up this morning than I did 4 years ago, when I actually watched and waited and watched and waited to see what was going to happen. And I made that conscious decision that, you know, I'm not going to do that this year, because I just had a sense that it was going to be this tight. And listening to, like I said, listening to the election officials and others. So when I got up this morning, got up, hopped on the treadmill, turned the TV on, like I've been doing the last couple of mornings, and say, okay, let's see what happens. And when it all pulled up, I went like, kind of what I thought was going to happen, pretty much happened. And so now I can just go on with my day, and we're in it. As Kathy said at the opening of the show, you know, now we sit back and we see what happens, because we're going to be in this for the long haul.
So Ernest Perry, with a lower heart rate and lower blood pressure than I this morning, because I mentioned I was watching both, I was watching MSNBC, NBC, ABC, flipping back and forth. I also had the laptop sitting on top too, and was going back and forth in two different browser tabs between online streams that were being done locally here in the Columbia Jefferson City market, both on KMIZ and on KOMU. Kathy, you were involved in the KOMU stream that was done here at the RJ studio with Jim Reek. Why don't you talk about a little bit of what went on there and how that made local television coverage a little different this year?
Yeah, well, KOMU decided to provide coverage outside of the regular TV platform. Like many other television stations, KOMU is now streaming And so we were, I think it was the first election night coverage where we were streaming on Roku, KOMU. And I think that actually is a nice option for viewers. KBIA also, during the election season, has made its regular programming available on some of its HD channels. So I think for consumers like Ernest who want to say, you know, wake me when it's over, this is a nice possibility. You might have to sleep for a few more weeks or months, Ernest, but it offers more of a choice, I think, for consumers. And so if you're a real junkie, you can jump online and you can watch to your heart's content. This, I think, is the beauty of digital platforms, is that you can dig as deep as you want, or you can just flip the channel and say, you know, I think I'll watch something else.
See, and one of the things about that I like, I have always been much more of a local news person. When I worked in television as a producer myself, it was for a 24-hour local channel, and our election coverage would be wall-to-wall, 6 p.m. until the last of the races was decided or could be called. And so it was not unusual for me to be in a control room calling a show from 6 p.m. live to 2 or 3 in the morning. So I miss that local focus, and one of the things I really appreciated was that I could watch the national but still have a constant look at what was going on in our gubernatorial race, to take a look at what was going on in the state legislature races that were going on there, and even on the county level where there maybe was a bit of an upset, to still be able to see what was happening in those races. Ernest, go ahead, Kathy, I'm sorry.
It's enormously important, because I think one of the things as the news business has contracted in ways that we've discussed ad nauseum on this show, one of the things that's suffered most is the coverage of local government. And I think that disempowers people, because if you think there's only one elected official in the United States of America, you expect that person to fix everything from foreign policy with Russia to the pothole on your street corner. And that's not the way it works. So I think the more coverage we can provide of local government, the more we remind people of where the levers of power really are, and so they can reach out and grab them. And I think that's so important.
Interestingly enough, though, there was at one point there was a tweet from a Columbia, Missourian reporter. This had to have been one of my favorite moments of the night. And Kathy, I'm looking at you laughing, so I'm thinking you might know which one I'm talking about. But he was covering the Parson campaign and was down in Springfield, and noted that the Associated Press had called Parson the winner, as holding on to the governor's mansion here in Missouri. But nobody there knew it, because they were watching Fox News and Fox News hadn't announced it. So it was like the reporters in the room knew that Parson had just been elected governor, yet because nobody at Parson's party, if you saw the video from there were a lot of people, no one there recognized or knew that he had just won and that they were a victory party. Best tweet ever. We're going to have to find that for everyone.
Well, that's the downside of digital silos, you know, that you have more choices, but if you don't use your choice in a wise fashion, you dig yourself into a silo and you miss a lot. You miss a lot of this world. That's classic, though. Great.
Other thoughts before? I did have one other thing I wanted to talk to you both about today, and it looks like we're going to have time to do that. But before we move on, are there any other thoughts that you would, either one of you, want to share about the election, or what our viewers, listeners, audience should be looking for, thinking about, or asking questions about in the next week before we have an opportunity to talk again?
Well, I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Amendment 3.
Then let's.
Because there was a lot of coverage by journalists across the state on that amendment. And the fact that the Yes Coalition won the election, I was a little surprised by that when I got up this morning and saw that, because I thought that, you know, the coverage that journalists had put out there had really done a good job of saying, you know, the language in this is something you really need to pay attention to, so that you know what it is that you're voting for. And we kept talking about that over and over and over again. But when you see some of the postmortem, it's going to be interesting to find out whether or not that coverage was effective in being able to do that, because the vote went yes and not no, and it pretty much wiped away.
So how would you measure
that was taken 2 years ago?
How would you measure that then? Because on the face of it, as somebody like me who doesn't do a whole lot of communication research, my first thought is, well, it obviously wasn't effective because that education campaign, people didn't understand what they were. Well, maybe they did understand what they were voting for, but in such
maybe
a way.
Did. I mean, That's what we're trying to. That's what we need to try to find out, is whether or not they did understand what it was that they were voting on and went that way. And that to me, that's going to be the interesting part.
I think that's a great point, because essentially what that vote was that it was a vote for incumbent protection. So really, the main interest group that would be behind that yes vote would be the current elected officials in the state of Missouri, which is actually a quite small group when you think about that over the entire population.
Who pretty much also all won re-election last night.
Right, yeah.
Yes, and so it's a big vote because it will decide who controls the redistricting. So it really effectively has a huge impact on political control in this state for the next 10 years. And somebody did a really great job of protecting incumbents on that vote. And I would say, I wonder if it was the effectiveness or ineffectualness of the media camp coverage, but I would also wonder, was there some political communications that were under the radar that we did not really notice? I know there was a lot of money spent in this race, but where was that money spent? Where did it go, and how was it actually reaching people? And I think it's harder to say now because so much political communication is on social media, and some of it's old gardens that we, you know, if you're an outsider, you can't see into.
So let me compare this for a second then to the right to work amendment that actually was kind of in the same way before Missouri voters. What was that? Maybe about a year, year and a half ago, Kathy? Was that before or after you got here? I don't remember. Do you remember?
Right. Yes,
okay.
I remember.
So we're looking at about year and a half, 2 years ago. And that was an amendment that really passed specifically because of Columbia, Springfield, Kansas City, and St. Louis, and nowhere else. I think it would be an interesting comparison to look at how that messaging was done compared to Amendment 3.
Go ahead. I was
going
to say, you know, I would say the difference between the right to work in this amendment was that this amendment was being voted on during a presidential election. And one of the things you'd have to also look at is how many people voted straight ticket. Mm-hmm. You know, even though we don't have to really have that, you have people who bubble that in. And if they connect a yes vote to a Republican vote, chances are that had a huge impact and a huge influence on how that amendment went the way it went.
Okay, well, that music means we are out of time for today. I'm sorry I didn't get to ask you that other question. Maybe we'll try it next week. I'd like to thank all of you for spending the last half hour with us. Remember, we are available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonKBIA. And of course, you can also find us right under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program. Again, leave us comments, questions, or just say hi. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you again next week.